Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, The Mighty Angel with the Open Scroll, and the reading, Revelation chapter 10.
Our study, we would ask our brother Graham Travis to read for us Revelation chapter 10.
Reading together the 10th chapter of the Apocalypse. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea, and his left upon the earth, and cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice out of heaven saying unto me, Seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea, and upon the earth, lifted up his hand to heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever and ever, who created heaven, and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again, and said, Go and take the little book, which is open in the hand of the angel, which standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel, and said unto him, Give me the little book. And he said unto me, Take it, and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, and it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, Thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings.
Thank you, Brother Graham. Now we will ask our Brother John Knowles to lead us in the study. The Mighty Angel with the Open Scroll.
Dear brethren and sisters and young people, well, we're back to our verse-by-verse study of Revelation chapter 10 now. For those who may have been away at the Bible school or for other reasons over the last few weeks, what we have been doing over the last four classes is to have a look at that section in Eureka entitled The Position of the Angel and How It is Acquired. The class before that, we actually started off looking at Revelation chapter 10, and we went very briefly through the chapter. So having looked in detail at this section in Eureka, entitled The Position of the Angel and How It is Acquired, we want to take up our study this evening from Revelation chapter 10 and verse 2 and proceed through the rest of the chapter. I anticipate that this evening's study should be comparatively simple. I've done this somewhat deliberately because over the last few weeks I think it's been fairly solid going, and I appreciate we have a number of young people here and some who are comparatively new in the truth. And maybe at times we do assume quite a bit of fundamental knowledge as far as prophecy is concerned, which may not always be right. So I'm not deliberately going back and trying to make it simple, but I think it will just naturally fall into that particular category this evening. I hope so. We're going to spend quite a bit of our time just looking at this second verse. What we've done up till now is we've established the characteristics of this angel. We've seen that this mighty angel with the rainbow around its head answers to the Yahweh coming upon a cloud of Isaiah 19, Deuteronomy 33, and all of those other passages in the Old Testament. But we're looking tonight particularly at verse 2, where we read that he had in his hand a little open book, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot on the earth. Now, this is the position which the angel had to acquire that Brother Thomas spoke so lucidly about in Eureka. But really, we didn't actually get down to specifically defining and expounding what it means by his foot upon the earth and upon the sea. On a couple of occasions I made glib reference to the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea of Revelation 13 and said, well, when we get to that you'll understand what it's all about. Possibly many of you may not have even been aware of that particular comment. And so whilst we've looked in considerable depth at many of the little details of the movement of this angel from Sinai and Teman and Seir and Egypt and so forth, I wonder whether maybe some of the younger ones found it a little bit difficult to follow because they didn't understand the overall picture. Now, in directing our attention to this matter of the right foot upon the sea and the left foot upon the earth, we really can't do any better than to go right back to Daniel chapter 2. Now, whilst here in Revelation chapter 10, we are looking at a different personage from this one which we have depicted here in Daniel chapter 10, And incidentally, for those who can't see the screen, we have simply projected up on the screen the chart which is found in our notes between pages 138 and 139. It is that chart entitled The Kingdom of Men, Christadelphian Teaching Since 1848. And we're looking in particular at this very well-known image of Daniel chapter 2. So as I said, whilst the personage in Revelation 10 is quite the opposite to this person in Daniel chapter 2, there is nevertheless a very definite relationship between the two of them. So let's go back and just see how much we do know about this vision of Daniel chapter 2. I'm not going to spell out all the obvious things about the head of gold and the chest and arms of silver and so forth, but we do want to look at the latter stages of this image, because this image itself, as we know from Daniel chapter 2, is a vision of the latter days. It represents the kingdom of men as it shall stand on its feet when the feet and toes have been formed. And so when this image stands up, it's going to have 2 feet. And those 2 feet are going to stand in a certain place, just as the feet of this rainbowed angel are going to stand in a certain place. And so to understand what's really going to happen, we have to see first of all what will happen to Nebuchadnezzar's man, and then we'll see how this rainbowed angel is going to be involved in accomplishing the same work. Now our chart here shows to us the kingdom of men in its various phases: the head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet part of iron and part of clay. And we just glibly define this as being Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome and divided Europe. But I'd like to remind you, because we have mentioned this previously, but then again, not everyone may be aware of this, that that is in fact an oversimplification of the various nations involved in the structure of this image. And if you weren't around when we previously defined it in the fashion which I'm now projecting up on the screen, I think it's very important indeed that you get a copy of these terms that we're projecting up here at the moment. Because it is in fact an oversimplification, simply to say that the head of gold is Babylon, chest and arms, Medo-Persia, and you know the rest of the story as we would present it in a public lecture. The terms that I have up here are not of my own making. They are in fact the definitions which Brother Thomas himself gives of the various components of the image. In fact, if you want to check them out, this definition is taken from Brother Thomas's publication, Elpis Israel, page 325, 326. I think you'll also find it in Exposition of Daniel. Now, what have we got here? We'll read out what's being projected up so that we can all copy it down, whether we are watching or just listening on tape. Now, Brother Thomas tells us that the head of gold represents the Chaldeo-Assyrian Empire. You can see what he's done here. He's linked together Chaldeo, C-H-A-L-D-E-O, and Assyrian. Chaldeo being another form of the word Chaldean. So that Chaldea was down in the area of Babylon, whereas Assyria was further up to the north. But you probably know, those of you who did the study of Daniel, that the Babylonian and Assyrian empires were really very closely related, because it was Nimrod who had built both the city of Nineveh, that's the capital of Assyria, and also the city of Babylon. So they both had the same founder. So when we talk about the Assyro-Babylonian Empire, or, as Brother Thomas has got it here, the Chaldeo-Assyrian, we're talking about two powers which are somewhat related. But you can see what happens. This term Assyrian goes through virtually all of the terms as we've got them listed here. So whilst the head then is the Chaldeo-Assyrian, the chest and arms are styled by him the Medo-Persic Assyrian, the Medo-Persian Assyrian, if you like. And so we've got the word Assyrian appended to the end of the Medo-Persian one as well. Now notice, we don't just talk about the belly and thighs being brass. We talk about the belly itself first of all, and then the thighs after that. Because after all, the belly is a unit, whereas the thighs constitute the beginning of the legs. And they are two units. And they really represent to us the two phases of the Greek Empire. In the early stage of the development of the Greek Empire, the rise of the Macedonian Empire, because you see Alexander the Great came from up in Macedon, it was simply the Macedo-Assyrian Empire. Macedon is a little bit to the north of what we would traditionally call Greece. So it's the Macedo-Assyrian Empire in its belly phase. But with the fall of the Greek Empire, or rather I should say with the fall of Alexander the Great, with the death of Alexander the Great, his empire was divided up amongst his four generals, who fought amongst themselves, and eventually they wiped out all bar two of them. In other words, two of them died and two of them remained. And they split up the empire into two parts, traditionally known in the book of Daniel as the kingdoms of the north and of the south. So that the king of the north and the king of the south, wherever it occurs in Daniel chapter 11, refers to the northern section of the Greek empire and the southern section. Consequently, then the two thighs show to us the breakup of the Greek empire. And these have been defined respectively as the Greco-Assyrian, which would be the northern section, and the Greco-Egyptian, which would be the southern section, the king of the north and the king of the south. Now, before we go any further, let me just explain to you why Brother Thomas has in fact kept appending this word Assyrian to the end of all of these terms. A quotation of his from Exposition of Daniel, in which he says, "In taking a general survey of the contents of the book of Daniel, it may be seen that two great powers are the principal subjects of its predictions. The one is styled the kingdom of men, and the other the kingdom of God. It is true that there are many symbols, such as the image, the fiery furnace, the tree stump banded with brass and iron, the four beasts, the ram, the he-goat, but these are signs in the prophetic heraldry, not of kingdoms, with an S on the end of it, not of kingdoms distinct and independent of those which have preceded them, but of one and the same kingdom of men in the several phases of its existence. That, therefore, is one kingdom," that chart that we had up there a moment ago. "It's one kingdom within different phases of its existence. It will be seen that the kingdom of men has been diversified in its constitution, its extent, and its throne since its foundation by Nimrod to the present time. It has nevertheless been the same Nimrudian kingdom with Babylon and Assyria for its characteristics." So that thinking power was Nimrod. It was a Nimrudian thinking power, and the brain, the head of that image, it exerts its influence right through the remaining structure of it. So whilst the kingdom of men may have changed from a Babylonian to a Medo-Persian phase, when it went from the head of gold to the chest and arms of silver, it was still Assyrian. It was still a Nimrod power. This Nimrod, the mighty hunter, who set himself up in defiance of Yahweh right back in the early part of Genesis. So it's Assyria going right through it. He calls it Assyria because Assyria came before Babylon. It was the early stage of the Chaldean empire. So then we've got down to the two thighs, the Greco-Assyrian and the Greco-Egyptian. Now when we come to the legs which we traditionally speak of as being the Roman Empire, this also of course has its twofold division, as we well know, Eastern Rome and Western Rome. And so we've got then a continuation of the Greco-Assyrian leg, which we already saw as part of the thigh. So the Greco-Assyrian is one leg of the image that answers to the Eastern leg, that section which was over in Constantinople. That's the Greco-Assyrian. And the other part of the empire was that one which was over in Rome, which was the western section of the empire, and that one he calls the Latino-Assyrian. Latin, you can see, Roman. So it's simply Greek and Roman, Greco and Latino, if you like. So we talk then about the Greek-Assyrian Empire of the East and the Latin or the Roman-Assyrian Empire of the West. So now the image is starting to orient itself around two areas, Constantinople in the east and Rome in the west. When we therefore come down to the feet and the toes are represented as the western section being still a continuation of the Latin Assyrian. So over in the west, we would still expect to see the Roman influence there. So the western leg will be the Latino Assyrian, the Roman one. The eastern section will still be the Greek Assyrian, but with the word Russian appended to the front of it. So under the heading of feet and toes, we've got down there Russo-Greek Assyrian in the east and Latino Assyrian in the west. So when that image stands on its feet, and it has not yet stood on its feet, it is going to stand on two feet. One is going to be a Russian-Greek Assyrian foot, and the other one is going to be a Latin Assyrian foot. Okay, so those are the two feet of the image of Nebuchadnezzar, and they are going to stand up astride Constantinople and Rome. Now, that's fairly simple, fairly basic, but maybe we've added in a few points there that some just weren't aware of. Now, that's very important, because it is this great image that the rainbowed angel of Revelation chapter 10, or its counterpart in the book of Daniel, the man of the one of Daniel chapter 10, it's this great image that these powers are going to do battle with. And so here they stand astride the east and western sections of the ancient Roman Empire. Right, so we've got then, back in Daniel, in Revelation chapter 10, the rainbowed angel now, he stands up with one foot upon the sea and one foot upon the earth. So what we're going to try and show now is that there is a relationship between the sea and the earth of Revelation chapter 10, and the position of the two feet of Nebuchadnezzar's image of Daniel chapter 2. To do this, it is going to be necessary just for a moment to go over to Revelation chapter 13, but I don't intend expounding it. In fact, it's probably just as easy to go back to our chart, that chart that we referred to earlier, the Kingdom of Men, Christadelphian teaching since 1848, because that chart presents to us sufficient information for our understanding this evening. Now, down in the bottom section of that chart, where we've shown that the Roman section of the image, the Roman section of the image, answers to the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, right over on the other side here, nearly off the screen. Whilst the legs here answer to that fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7, in the book of Revelation, that beast is broken down into the smaller components of the Roman Empire. So whereas, as far as Daniel was concerned, he saw all of the phases of the Roman Empire incorporated into this one beast, which was dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, which had 10 horns, and then there came up another little horn, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked up by the roots, and all this sort of thing. In Revelation, we have different beasts representing different phases of this particular fourth beast of Daniel 7. So that in Revelation chapter 12, we have the great red dragon. And that answers to the phase of Roman history up to the time of Constantine, up to the time when pagan Rome became so-called Christian Rome, or as we have defined it, Catholic Rome. Now, after the passing of the dragon phase in chapter 12, we come to chapter 13, where we are introduced to two beasts. One is styled the beast of the sea, in chapter 13, verses 1 to 10. It is the beast of the sea because it came up out of the sea. Chapter 13, verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. So then here is a beast which is directly related to the sea. We come over to verse 11 on the other hand. Come over to verse 11 of the same chapter. And we read there, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And so we've got two beasts here, one related to the sea, the other related to the earth. One comes up out of the sea, the other one comes up out of the earth. Now bear in mind, the rainbowed angel, when he stands up, has one foot upon the sea, that area from which this beast of Revelation 13 verses 1 to 10 comes up, and one foot upon the earth, the domain of this other beast, verses 11 to the end of the chapter. So then, the sea and the earth of Revelation chapter 10 are going to be shown as being the domains of two particular beasts answering to two particular phases of the Roman Empire. Now, as far as our definition tonight is concerned, the note on the chart will be quite sufficient to define it for us. The beast of the sea represents Rome in development from 493 AD to 800 AD, showing the eclipse of the imperial system and its rejuvenation in the Justinian epoch, giving papal privileges. The beast of the earth, on the other hand, and the image of the beast, represents the development of the Holy Roman Empire from 800 AD onwards, up to the time of the great earthquake, at the time of the French Revolution, the time of Napoleon, when the Holy Roman Empire came to an end. So if we were to, say, glance at a map of Europe, not that this particular one necessarily is the right time period, but it's still Europe, so it will do for what we want at the moment. We've got here then the beast of the sea answering to the early phase of the existence of Rome, which is the Roman power itself, particularly here over in the east. And then we've got the later stage, which is the Holy Roman Empire, which is up here in Europe. So we've got a European phase of the Roman Empire, as against the earlier phase, which was more particularly a Roman phase. So when the rainbowed angel stands up, he's going to judge both the European power and the Roman power. Now I see here a very definite relationship between what we said earlier, that when that image stands upon its feet, it will be a Russo-Greek Assyrian, it will be essentially a European power, one which has come down through Turkey, and it will also be a Roman power. There will be, as we often say, a confederation between the two, or a coalition of expediency. So just as Daniel's image, or Nebuchadnezzar's image, is to stand up upon its eastern and western feet, so there appears to be a relationship between the feet of this image and the feet of the rainbowed angel, so that the right foot of the rainbowed angel is going to stand on the sea, and the left foot upon the earth, answering to the two aspects of the judgment which is to be poured out when the Lord Jesus Christ sets forth in company with the saints. So it is that at the Battle of Armageddon, when Russia comes down into the land and when she is destroyed, so it is that the Russo-Greek Assyrian League is judged. But then it's necessary for the proclamations to go forth, such as we have in Revelation chapter 14, demanding papal Rome to submit. And therefore it will be the work of the next 40 years for the rainbowed angel to bring about his judgments on the Latino Assyrian leg of the image. And so just as the rainbowed angel has to stand astride both the sea and the earth, so the image stands astride two different legs, one being Russian and the other being Roman. And so in its simplicity we say that Russia is judged at Armageddon, at the time when she invades the land, and Rome is judged in the 40-year period following on the Battle of Armageddon. And that's explained here in the terms that he had his right foot upon the sea, that is the arena of the beast of the sea, and his left foot on the earth, that is the arena of the beast of the earth. I guess this will become even clearer when we get to Revelation chapter 13 and we can prove in more detail what these two beasts actually are. So this particular angel of Daniel chapter 10 and verse 2 has this little open scroll, and he stands with his feet astride both the sea and the earth. And we're told in verse 3 that he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. So this crying answers to the many passages in the Old Testament where we read about Yahweh roaring out of Zion. There's a couple of passages which we've noted in our notes here, and they're well worth looking at because they're both on the same page anyway. It won't take us long. Joel chapter 3 verse 16 and Amos chapter 1 verse 2. In Joel 3 and verse 16, we've got the result of the judgment upon Russia. This is the first phase of the judgment by the rainbowed angel, as a result of which we read in Joel 3 verse 16, Yahweh also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake, but Yahweh will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. Or in Amos chapter 1 and verse 2, and he said, Yahweh will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the habitations of the shepherd shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. So here we've got then the roaring, the lion roaring out of Zion. And it answers in general terms to what we've got here in Revelation chapter 10. Part of this roaring, which we've just defined here in Joel 3:16 and Amos chapter 1 verse 2, will be the roaring that will go out of Zion subsequent to the destruction of Gog. Of course, as far as Revelation chapter 10 is concerned, it incorporates both the roaring after the destruction of Gog and the roaring before it. But as far as the roaring after the destruction of Gog is concerned, we've said very little in our previous studies. Over the last four nights, we've been looking particularly at those events which would lead up to the Gogian destruction. And we've passed off very quickly the events which will take place after that. If we go over for a minute or two to Revelation chapter 14, we've got a more detailed description of the roaring out of Zion, which will take place after Gog has been destroyed, and when the Lord has established his throne in Zion, but not as yet, brought the Latino Assyrian leg of the image into subjection. Revelation 14 verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and a tongue and people. We've already seen, when it says, I saw another angel, it doesn't mean to say we've got to look now for a different personage or a different group. It's just another aspect of this same power again. It's still the rainbowed angel, still the Lord Jesus Christ, still exactly the same power, but now performing a different facet of work. And so this facet of work is proclaiming the everlasting gospel. Not so much the gospel of salvation. It simply means Aeonian good news. And the good news which this angel is proclaiming is stated in verse 7. Saying with a loud voice, here's this roaring voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. So the first proclamation which this lion roars out of Zion is in fact a merciful proclamation. It's a proclamation offering people acceptance at the hand of God, providing they will fear him and give glory to him, acknowledging the hour of his judgment as having come. Now, although it doesn't say how many accept and how many do not accept, other parts of Scripture indicate to us that certain powers will accept this. Psalm 72 is undoubtedly couched in the terms of the British powers having accepted it. But the very next verse here tells us that there is one power that will not accept, and that is the Latin Assyrian leg of the image, here styled Babylon. Verse 8, there followed another angel. Actually, it's still the same angel, but it's now the second phase of its work. The first proclamation was a proclamation of mercy. The mercy having been rejected by Babylon, this power now has to suffer. So verse 8, there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So the Latin Assyrian leg of the image begins to fall. Doesn't fall completely, because the influence of that Latin leg of the image was not just confined to the city of Rome, but it extended up into Europe as well. So consequently then there has to be the third angel, still the same angel, but now in another phase of its work, indicating that whilst there was a group of people who had rejected the merciful proclamation, and the same group of people had witnessed the fall of Babylon and still not done anything about it, we're then told in verse 9, and a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. We hope to show, God willing, when we eventually get to that section, that this answers to the judgment of that 40-year period during which the refined third of Judah, under the leadership of Elijah, with Yahweh being seen over them, in other words, the saints guiding them, when they shall go out to the nations to gather Israel back, to gather the tribes of Ephraim back, having to fight their way through the nations, they will bring the judgments of God upon this area, which is the area of Europe in general, styled here those who worship the beast. And so then, this roaring of the lion out of Zion is a roaring to the nations, first of all to submit, secondly announcing the fall of Babylon, and thirdly punishments upon those who will not heed either the first or the second proclamation. And so, as Ezekiel 20 showed us in our previous studies, when they're gathered into the wilderness of the people, when the children of Israel are gathered into the wilderness of the people, the rebels will be purged out from among them. The rebels will be purged out as a result of the warfare which will be engaged in. So this roaring of the lion then, of Revelation chapter 10, incorporates such details as we have here in Revelation 14. Those who have been with us for a fair bit of the study will recall that we have shown that Revelation chapter 10 is itself a climax. It's a climax of God's judgments on Catholic Rome. We're then going to go back in chapter 11 and commence to look at another aspect of God's judgments on Rome. So it is really quite legitimate to jump over to Revelation 14 and say, here are details in Revelation 14 which fill in some of the facts of Revelation 10. Because while it simply talks about earth and sea in Revelation 10, Yahweh presumes that having read the whole of the book, we will see the significance of it when it's explained in more detail in perhaps subsequent chapters. Similarly, of course, when it tells us here in Revelation chapter 10 that the rainbowed angel is going to roar like a lion, he doesn't tell us exactly what he is going to roar. It just says, and he cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth. But when we turn to passages like Revelation 14, we are told some of the things that he will be roaring. And we have been looking there, of course, at the second phase of the roaring, that is the roaring after he is enthroned in Zion. Going back then to Revelation chapter 10, we read, and when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices. And as Brother Thomas suggests, he said, well, there's two ways of looking at that. You can say they're seven successive thunders, or it can be a general description of the seven spirits of deity thundering forth. And that, in fact, he says, is the interpretation which he prefers. And I think you might even find an extract from that somewhere in the notes there. I think towards the bottom of page 114. The last seven or eight lines on that page. The rainbowed angel is the seven spirits incorporate in Jesus and his brethren, going forth in their wars into all the earth. Hence the connection between the lion roar of his voice and the voices of the seven thunders. The thunders are therefore the echoes of the voice of the all-powerful and omniscient seven. They are the wars of the saints in the execution of the judgment written and given to them and waged against Babylon and the apocalyptic beasts until the wrath of deity is filled up and the smoke from his glory and power no longer prevents an entrance into the nave. And again, assuming a knowledge of Revelation chapter 15. So really, what we've got here then in Revelation chapter 10 verses 1, 2 and 3 is a summary of the twofold judgments which the Lord will carry out when he stands with one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth, or in other terms, when he will judge the two legs of Daniel's image, and when that image will finally come crashing down to the ground to be broken to pieces together. It mightn't hurt just for a moment to go back to Daniel chapter 2. It will serve as revision for some. It may be new for one or two others. But in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel is quite specific as to the various stages of the destruction of this image. In Daniel chapter 2 and at verse 35, speaking of the work which this little stone will do, we read, "Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together." Notice the word "together." They'll all be broken to pieces at the same time, showing us it's a latter day vision. "And became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors." There it is, Armageddon, the sheaves which have been threshed in the valley of judgment. "And the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the earth." So the stone doesn't instantly fill the whole earth. The stone, first of all, becomes a great mountain, and then it fills all the earth. So just as there are two stages in the judgment upon the nations, so there are two stages in the establishment of the kingdom. If you happen to come across in Brother Thomas's writings the statement, "the stone kingdom of Judah," and it frequently occurs in both Eureka and particularly in the Mystery of the Covenant. You may recall I mentioned a couple of classes ago that it's very worthwhile at this stage to read the Mystery of the Covenant. He talks about the stone kingdom of Judah, by which he means that when Gog has been overthrown, the Jews who are in the land at that stage are styled Judah. The Lord establishes himself in Jerusalem, and as we saw from previous classes, having cleansed the area of land which had been promised to Abraham, he sets himself up then as king over Judah, ruling over the territory of land promised to Abraham. But he's not really king over the whole earth at that stage. So that this little stone has at this stage now become a mountain, Mount Zion. So that is the stone kingdom of Judah. And it is the stone kingdom of Judah which exists for 40 years. Until, of course, the judgments of Revelation 14 have taken place. And all Israel has been gathered back. At which time, the stone will then have grown to such an extent that it will fill the whole earth. So the two phases of the establishment of the kingdom involve the stone becoming a mountain, and then the mountain ultimately filling the whole earth. So the stone kingdom of Judah extends eventually into the kingdom of Israel and Judah. Brother Thomas again lines this up with David. Back on that note on page 114, the beginning of that last paragraph says, "The seven thunders speak of the complete subjugation of mankind after the Lord's victory on the mountains of Israel. Compare the type of David, who after establishing his power, having established his power in Jerusalem, then extended his dominion by seven campaigns." So David was a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. He didn't reign over all Israel and Judah. It was firstly over a part, and then later on over the whole of the kingdom of Israel and of Judah. So then, it's important to see that this judgment on the image, the destruction of the image, is not the work of an instant of time, but it's going to be part of that first 50-year period, that period between the time in which the Lord returns and the Jubilee period when the temple is opened, that these judgments will be progressively carried out. Well, we can go back then to Revelation chapter 10. And carry on from there. Verse 5. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon